call Uncle Ted Uncle Ted all the time. So we'll, young guy on the block, so we'll call him Nephew Biggins.
Alaska's new senator takes the oath in Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 6th of January. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, state lawmakers contemplate tough budget challenges ahead.
We'd made a commitment 5 years ago, 6 years ago, to adequately fund the state's education system. That takes money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell HKM, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowellhkm.com. Support for APR and coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Alaska has a new U.S. senator. Former Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich was sworn in today in the Senate chambers. He's the first Democrat to represent Alaska in nearly 30 years. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington, D.C.
Mark Begich was sworn in on the Senate floor, where he'll serve for the next 6 years. Only select family members and staff witnessed it from inside the Senate gallery. Scores of his supporters watched on a TV in a nearby Senate reception room. Just after noon local time, the recently elected senators, both freshmen and returning, stepped forward in batches of four to take the oath of office. Alaska's senior senator, Lisa Murkowski, escorted Begich forward.
The clerk will read the names of the first group.
Mr. Alexander of Tennessee, Mr. Barrasso of Wyoming, Mr. Baucus of Montana, Mr. Begich.
Vice President Dick Cheney delivered the oath.
Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you are about to enter, so help you God.
I do.
Congratulations.
Afterward, Begich sat at his official Senate desk.
Then as I was sitting there and watching the next group after the next group, it just was an incredible moment in history, not only for Alaska, but for this great country. And being part of that is just an amazing thing.
Begich is continuing a family tradition. His father, Nick Begich, served one term as Alaska's representative at large before his plane disappeared in 1972 during his reelection campaign. Mark Begich took his oath on the same Bible as his father.
The Bible is a family Bible. It's my mom's and dad's. And so a lot of history in there. Each birth of the child is listed in there. The death of my father is listed in there. So it's a very important Bible for us. I was sworn in as mayor on that, and then my dad was sworn in the U.S. Congress with that.
It was an emotional day for the entire Begich family. Mark's mother, Peggy, says her husband would have been proud of their son.
Just so many emotions were going through me. I was just very proud and very humbled all at the same time. I mean, to see one of your children be sworn in as a U.S. senator is just this incredible experience. Kind of takes your breath away.
It wasn't only family members who were touched by the swearing in. Terry Albrecht is in her 50s and has worked for Begich in the Anchorage mayor's office. But when she was 18 years old, she worked on his dad's congressional campaign. She was one of dozens of supporters who made the trek from Alaska to celebrate with the new senator.
I swear it's like I can see his dad. Absolutely marvelous. You don't usually get to see this and be involved, being homegrown like that. And my son's a fifth-generation Alaskan, so there's a lot of pride in Alaska. But Mark's, he's everyone's son. He really is.
People filled the crowded reception to congratulate Alaska's new senator, a mix of family members and friends, campaign supporters, political allies, and those who hope to gain favor with him. Anthony Edwardson from Barrow is president of his native corporation and is visiting Washington to oversee its government contracts. He made sure to stop by and shake Begich's hand.
Got to support him at the very get-go, and this is our chance to give him our warm appreciation for Barrow and for the Wood-Cavalcanti Corporation.
Edwardson says his corporation was used to having the ear of Begich's predecessor, Ted Stevens, and the earmark dollars he directed to the state.
I think it's going to be a tough challenge for everybody, but you know, we just got to have our hopes up for our new senator, and we'll call him Nephew Begich. We call Uncle Ted all the time, so we'll... Young guy on the block, so we'll call him Nephew Begich.
For Begich's campaign manager, Heather Rausch, it was a sweet moment to see so many people gathered in support. She says it's especially gratifying after a long campaign that didn't wrap up until 2 weeks after Election Day.
It does bring a sense of closure since we weren't able to get that on election night with the election not being too close to be called, and then them continuing to count votes for the weeks after. This does provide a sense of closure.
As one chapter ends, another begins. Now for Begich, the real work of Congress starts. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Begich has been given his committee assignments. He'll serve on the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee and on the Armed Services Committee. Armed Services covers the military and its various branches. It's also concerned with pay and other benefits for military service members. Begich says he's pleased with the assignment.
It's one of the ones I had selected that I'd hoped to be on. It obviously helps Alaska really continue to put ourselves on the map as important to the national defense, but also how it shows us strategically in the world. And Alaskan, I can't recall a time Alaskan's been on the Armed Services Committee. So this is a huge benefit for us.
The Commerce Committee covers the highways, marine and air transportation, communications, fisheries, and the Coast Guard. It also deals with issues of climate change and science. Begich's predecessor, Senator Ted Stevens, served on the Commerce Committee as a Republican. It's chaired by Democrat Daniel Inouye of Hawaii. Inouye and Stevens had a uniquely close working relationship across party lines. Inouye says despite his sadness at losing Stevens as a colleague, he's welcoming Begich with open arms and attended the new senator's reception today.
Well, I'm here to congratulate Senator Begich, wish him well, and to assure him that all the help he needs on Alaska, all he has to do is give me a call.
Inouye also sits on the powerful Appropriations Committee, as did Senator Stevens, but it was a long shot for Begich to get on as a freshman. Still, Inouye says he'll be watching out for Begich and Alaska's needs from his seat on the committee. It would be an understatement to say the new state legislature faces some challenges in writing a budget this year. With recent oil prices hovering around $45 a barrel, there's no evidence that state revenue will be able to cover the needs for this next year or the next one. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports the savings account will be essential.
Both House and Senate finance chairs see a fiscal shortfall when they start looking at the $5 billion budget the governor sent them. The size of that shortfall will depend on oil prices, though. The budget was based on an expectation of oil averaging $74 a barrel. Current estimates put that average at about $50 a barrel. Senate Republican Bert Stedman says coming up with a reasonable starting place will determine how far budget writers can go.
We're going to have a revenue stream into the state. And the question is how big of a draw in deficit years are we going to need? And we'll be spending some time this winter looking at different scenarios and projecting the life of that. And the goal is to extend our savings to the point where we get to first gas.
Extending current financial reserves to first gas production in a gas line to the lower 48 would be optimistic. That would require stretching the savings to somewhere between 2017 and 2019. Previous legislators have not set that much money aside. Although the reserves are sufficient to prevent an immediate fiscal disaster, as other states are anticipating.
$1 billion in forward funding education. We've got $1 billion in the statutory budget reserve, which takes a simple majority vote of the legislature. And then we've got the constitutional budget reserve. Those are the three big pots.
The Constitutional Budget Reserve holds $6.6 billion, itself more than the entire budget the governor proposed this year. However, while the legislature can control most expenses for governmental services, House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker says growth comes in non-discretionary items, such as pension expenses, catching up on deferred maintenance, and at the top, education needs.
we'd made a commitment 5 years ago, 6 years ago, to adequately fund the state's education system. That takes money. So, you know, we really look at where the growth and expenditures have been. It's where the public wanted to see the growth. Now we all have to get together and figure out how we're going to pay for it.
Hawker and Stedman agree a lot of people expect increased appropriations this year, but the focus will likely be limited. However, Hawker says they must not ignore new ideas. That's how to prepare for the future.
We've got to look at what kind of education policy do we want long-term, long-term state energy policy, long-term state health care policy, and long-term public safety infrastructure. I mean, these are the issues that, you know, that's the job of a legislature. It's the job of a governor is to answer these questions every single year under every possible financial circumstance.
Both co-chairs agree on one other point. The national economic conditions mean the divisive question of whether permanent fund earnings should be used won't be on the table this year. Neither expects nearly enough reserves to make a difference in the state's budget needs. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new state program to help kids in foster care.
You know, when you're 13 years old and you look different than everybody else, that's a real problem. That's the biggest problem in your life at times when you're 13.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
A crab fisherman aboard the Kodiak-based Seabrook fell overboard this morning when his foot got tangled in a line while he was setting pots for tanner crab about 20 miles northwest of Cold Bay. Coast Guard Petty Officer Walter Shin said they do not think he was wearing any sort of flotation device, and the crew could not see him after he fell into the 34-degree water with 4-foot seas. Three Coast Guard helicopters began searching for the 40-year-old man at about 11 a.m. and will continue until sunset, although he is presumed dead. This is the first Bering Sea crab fishing fatality since 2005, when crab rationalization went into effect. Injury epidemiologist Jennifer Lincoln says the program might have improved safety for the fishery, but the biggest improvement actually came in October of 1999, when the Coast Guard began making safety and stability checks on all of the vessels.
If they had too many pots on board, or they were loaded improperly, or if their survival gear wasn't up to date or missing or something, they wouldn't let them sail.
In the 1990s, 8 crab fishermen died on average each year. After the Coast Guard started checking stability and pot numbers, only 2 people died during the next 4 seasons. The next big accident was the sinking of the Big Valley in January of 2005, when 5 men were lost. Currently, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health is testing different styles of PFDs with different fishermen to try to find ones that are easy to wear while working. The state launched a new program today called Fosterware to help make sure kids in foster care have adequate clothing. The idea is to offer deep discounts to foster care families at retail outlets around the state. One store has signed on to the program, and the state hopes many more will follow. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Outdoor clothing and gear store REI in Anchorage is the only store currently participating in the program. The retailer is giving foster kids a 25% discount on all clothing and footwear items and free gear rentals. Store manager Mike Herzog says it was the right thing to do.
You know, we just hope that a whole bunch of other retailers will join us, because I think it's important that we get kids out there in good gear, good clothing, so that they can fit in, but also so that they can enjoy the activities that are available here in Alaska. And you can't do that in poor clothing.
The idea for the program came directly from kids in the foster care system. Teenagers in a group called Facing Foster Care in Alaska included it on a list of goals for improving their experience. Amanda Mativier, a young foster care parent who spent 3 years in the system herself, is president of the group. She says the clothing stipend parents receive from the state is far from adequate.
We kept hearing this over and over, you know, young people saying, I don't have clothes, or, you know, my foster parents won't buy me clothes because, you know, they get a stipend, but it's really not enough, and it stretches pretty thin. And so this is, you know, an awesome way for businesses to really get involved, you know, and support foster families.
And Mativier says good clothes are important for self-esteem.
There was a young man in Fairbanks who, he had to move schools because he was placed in foster care. So he went to a new high school. It was his junior year. He was 16. He didn't have shoes for some reason. And so he had to wear his younger sister's Barney boots to his first day at a new school at 16 years old. And so, I mean, if it's not traumatizing enough to be placed in foster care and then to have to, you know, come to school and experience that, I think that's almost abuse in itself to have to go through that kind of thing.
Anchorage area lawmaker Les Guerra, a Democrat, knows the struggles foster care kids face firsthand. He grew up in foster care in New York State. Guerra helped make the new state program a reality. He says there are plenty of bigger issues plaguing the state's foster care system, but that doesn't mean the new program isn't an important one.
There are so many problems, and if you get overwhelmed and say we can't do anything because the problems are too big, then you just lose from the outset. This is certainly among the smaller of the problems, but a real one. You know, when you're 13 years old and you look different than everybody else, that's a real problem. That's the biggest problem in your life at times when you're 13.
Guerra plans to introduce legislation in the upcoming session to reform foster care. He says more foster care parents are badly needed, along with more social workers to help them. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska officials have set up a vaccination tracking system. The online database will help patients and health care providers make sure they're up to date on measles, tetanus, and other immunizations. Doctors and clinics will need to provide the information. Laura Wood of the state's immunization program says experience elsewhere shows the system will have enough data to be useful within a year.
That can be really helpful because as more and more vaccines are being recommended and people tend to get vaccines at more than one location or with more than one provider, it can be really confusing about whether the person has received all the immunizations that they need.
Wood says only healthcare providers will be allowed access to the database. It will be encrypted and password protected to safeguard patient privacy. Officials may eventually allow parents to access their child's records. They may also let schools check which students are up to date on immunizations. But those systems are not yet in place. Most other states already have a similar database, but they're not interconnected. Still, Wood says health departments contact each other to track information. For example, Alaska used Louisiana's system to help families that moved here after Hurricane Katrina.
We were able to contact the individuals in Louisiana who support their similar system as to what we're getting ready to establish. And we're often able to get full immunization information for the patients that they could then use to enter school or child care. And so it proved to be an incredible benefit when most records that people had in their homes were lost.
The system is being called VacTrack and will be managed by Alaska's Division of Public Health.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Sub-zero temperatures have canceled a third day of competition of the U.S. Cross-Country Ski Championships in Anchorage. Races took place on Monday, but today organizers waited more than an hour past the original noon start time before calling off a pair of distance races. Skiers won't compete unless the temperatures hit at least 4 degrees below zero or higher. Temperatures hovered in that range, but organizers were not confident that threshold would be sustained for the entire afternoon. Over the weekend, temperatures exceeding 10 degrees below zero kept skiers from competing in sprint races. Organizers and coaches will meet later this evening to discuss options for the remaining races, with only 2 days left in the event. Despite even more extreme cold weather in the interior, Fairbanks School District officials say classes there will go on as usual. North Starboro School District spokesman Bill Bailey says with today's resumption of classes following the holiday break, the district heard from a lot of parents concerned about the cold.
Parents started calling yesterday asking if school was going to be canceled or was school's still going to be open because of the cold weather. And basically it's just questions about, is there a school district policy that states school closes when the temperature drops to a certain level?
Bailey says the district does not have a policy dictating a cutoff temperature when schools close.
There's some administrative regulations that talk about activities, after-school programs and things like that, field trips, where once temperature hits minus 40, there's some changes made there. But it doesn't state that school will be canceled or closed. It's normal operating procedures to keep the schools open.
Bailey says the only time schools would close is when the district's bus contractor deems it unsafe to operate. He says to current district officials of knowledge, Fairbanks schools have never been closed due to fog or ice, or cold or ice fog. The Bristol Bay Health Corporation is laying off 13 people and eliminating other positions due to hard economic times. From member station KDLG, Adam Kane reports.
While there have been minor deficits in the past, this is the first time that the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation in Dillingham will be operating under a planned deficit. As a result of the deficit, drastic measures have been taken and 13 employees have been laid off, as well as 5 positions being reduced. BBAHC Human Resources Director Jack Davis describes the situation taking place within the corporation.
Specifically, our community health representatives. There are 5 community health reps that we are laying off, and all these layoffs are effective the 31st of January.
The community health representatives were not caregivers in the villages. They worked mainly in the field of education. He goes on to say that the layoffs weren't limited to the community health representatives.
Our house, our respite caregivers for the severely mentally ill, there were 3 layoffs there. Basic life support system trainer from our emergency services was laid off, as was a call-in trainer. Our maternal and child health service program was cut.
Davis says that there were also reductions to 5 positions, including the hospital audiologist, the injury prevention specialist, an optometry assistant, and 2 respite caregivers. Hospital Director Robert Clark explains that the layoffs were the end result of many combined factors.
Our biggest costs were like fuel, electricity. We tried like heck to get a windmill at Michigak. That didn't fare out. We missed two funding cycles now on that. We're still probably going to be pursuing some of the energy cost areas. Our medevac was up over $700,000 over the last couple of years. Electricity is up. Pharmaceuticals are up. You name it, everything's up on essentially a fixed budget, which means we're going backwards.
Due to those high costs, the hospital is beginning the new year with between a $550,000 and $600,000 planned deficit, which is unsustainable for any prolonged amount of time.
We're having to just pare back and just watch the budget very tightly. As you know, you look at the costs in town, the fuel, the airfare. I mean, we're stuck with that, and we're a 24/7 business, 365, so there's a lot of things that are beyond our control.
Clark mentions the possibility of more layoffs in April, which is when the corporation conducts its mid-year budget review. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Native leader Willie Hensley's book, 50 Miles from Tomorrow, has only been out a couple of weeks, but so far sales are brisk. The book is a memoir that spans the early years of Hensley's career, from growing up in a house made of Arctic sod through the successful passage of the Native Claims Settlement Act. Hensley says it's important for natives to tell their own stories. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Willie Hensley will be the first one to tell you there are problems with the Native Claims Settlement Act, which passed in 1971 and put native land in the control of corporations rather than tribes. But as his book points out, the window of opportunity to get it passed was not open very long. The oil industry wanted to develop Prudhoe Bay, but the state was prevented by the Interior Department from selecting the land for a pipeline until native claims were dealt with.
We never really had the time to really think about the future. You know, had we had the chance to really communicate both within our generation and a generation or two before us about how to structure something it might have come out differently. But we really never had that opportunity. You remember, from the time we finally realized the situation where the land was about to be taken by the state, it was only 5 years.
The result was a system of corporations to control Native lands that, with some tweaking, has kept the land in Native hands and generated significant development efforts, jobs, and profits. The book offers Hensley's take on the people who populate Alaska's history books, like Bill Egan, Wally Hickel, Emil Nadi, and Mike Gravel. But its heart is the personal memories of a subsistence lifestyle and the attractions of the outside world, leavened with some reflections on how multiple cultures have intertwined. While Hensley relished his own educational opportunities, he provides a sobering perspective on the assimilative philosophy which too often governed the schooling of Native youth.
And until I started writing, I never really understood sort of the nature of the forces that had been changing us actually a long time before I showed up. In a way, my own experience is reflective of tens of thousands of other people who, in some respects, had lost control of their own destiny because of the government, and in some instances, economics. And we didn't have any control over the institutions and decision-making processes that began to affect us.
And Hensley says the statehood effort of 50 years ago largely ignored Alaska Natives. Had they had a place among the 55 who gathered to write the state's constitution, he suggests, a lot of future political strife might have been avoided.
You know, had we had decent representation at the Constitutional Convention, I think we could have been able to deal with land issues, subsistence issues, language issues, education issues. So all of these things that we should have been able to have had a chance to talk about at that time really weren't talked about.
Natives need to tell their own story, Hensley says. It's something all can learn from. And a storyteller can never tell quite what detail is going to strike a responsive chord in the reader.
And when I sent some 14 chapters into my editor, wanting some feedback to know if I was on the right track, you'd think she'd like all this warfare over the land settlement and all the politics and the oil and the conservationists and the state and all this. No. The chapter she enjoyed the most was this little description about the Ivrulik, you know, the sod house that we lived in, which I was somewhat shocked by, but most Americans can't conceive of living in that kind of a situation that we lived in when I was a boy.
Willie Hensley appeared on Talk of Alaska this week as part of a national tour to promote his book that will take him down the West Coast and to Washington, D.C. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Adam Kane in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. Have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.